And it all converges behind this curtain that the customer never appreciates. This incredible complexity. Incredible complexity and traceability to get my flight tomorrow morning in the sky. And I love sitting on top or sitting in front of all that complexity. And there is never-ending detail in that complexity of how much there is to know, how much it is just to get that one airplane in the sky. And it people just take that for granted. Ultimately, and the thing that I really love, and this is what I pressed upon the lady, that I'm actually part of this incredible magic that occurs every single day.
Well, Todd, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast to chat with me today.
My pleasure, Ed.
For those listening in who might not know you, are you able to do a little bit of an introduction? So your name, your title, the organization you work for, and then I also like to chuck in things about what you're passionate about.
Todd Chapman is the name. I work for myself these days. I've got my own management consulting practice specializing in aviation called Leading Edge Management Consulting. I've been doing that almost for exactly 3 years, which came on the back of 20 years within the Qantas Group, and then another few years within other airlines, including Ansett and Hazelton. I also originally started out my aviation career by learning to fly, did that for a couple of years, did a diploma of aeronautics at the time. And I did it for long enough to realize that I would make, in fact, it was actually an instructor who said to me, he said, Todd, you'll make a very frustrated airline pilot. And was such wise words, because I'd be a very frustrated airline pilot. I'm not good at high repetition tasks or sustained attention to detail that which would define a pilot career. Obviously, I can do it for my job very well, but not in a cockpit environment. And so consequently, after those 2 years, I then pivoted to what I found to be an absolutely dream career on the ground for nearly 30 years now. For your interest, Em, I still fly aeroplanes though, but I do it recreationally. I'm actually even a flying instructor, and I actually teach people how to glide because I fly gliders. So my aviation cup is filled with flying to the right amount that it suits me, but my aviation bucket, which is my passion for the industry, is filled with what I do on the ground with my clients and all sorts of aspects of the aviation industry. You did ask me what I was passionate about, Em.
Yes.
And I did give that away, which it is aviation. I remember when I mixed with my family, I they often see me as a little bit of a nerd or a freak. But when I go to work with my clients, or indeed many of the people listening to this podcast, I just see them as fellow aviation tragics, because there is something about our industry that is it's got this magnetic quality that attracts people in, and they just build careers that are almost addictive in nature. They even attempt to leave, and then you see them coming back again. I'm one of those people. I was born with the aviation gene. One of my earliest memories was sitting in the backyard of my house at Neutral Bay in 1974, waiting for the Concorde's inaugural flight to visit Australia, because the newspaper at the time had said that it was going to fly over my house, and I was a little 7-year-old boy, and my mum must have showed me the newspaper or something, and I waited all afternoon to see it. That was just, one of my earliest memories was something around aeroplanes. And to this day, it's my abiding passion. I never tire of it. And luckily, I've been able to build a career around that.
So you kind of hinted at it already. So was it kind of those experiences of, being a kid and seeing the planes fly over your house? And then also learning to fly later that kind of inspires your passion for the industry, or were there other kind of like stepping stones in between those two things?
It's a really great question. I actually, my personal one is I just was born with it. I just know that for a fact. And I know exactly who the gene came from. And it's my maternal uncle, Peter. He and I can pick up the phone and we just talk about the industry. And it's like I'm talking to a mirror. The things that he's interested in are the things that I'm interested in. And so I just know it's at a DNA level for me. For your interest, one of the things I did in Qantas Regionals is that I ran the pilot recruitment system, or their program. I ran it for over 5 years. And I was doing, and this is a, you know, people are inclined to exaggerate numbers. This is a factual number, but every one of those 5 years, I was doing more than 100 interviews per year because of the, because of the growth of the airline, but also because of the rollover of the pilot group. Point of the story is that I have this incredible sample size of doing pilot interviews, of which to comment on many things. And Em, one of my standard questions was, so how did you get interested in aviation in the first place? Just like you asked me. And ironically, unlike my answer to you where I confessed it was on a DNA level, what I heard on, I would estimate around about 80% of occasions, was a story that went something like, when I was a kid, my parents and I, or my family and I, were traveling to, insert destination here, and the flight attendant asked if I wanted to go up and have a look at the cockpit. And I went up there and I was amazed at the gauges. I was just blown away by the view of looking in front instead of out the side of the airplane. And the pilots, you know, and the uniforms are just so friendly. I just loved the technology, the power, the fact that these guys are just sitting up the front managing all of that. And from that moment, I wanted to be a pilot. 80% of people actually said that to me, and it's really interesting. And what actually intrigues me is, I was doing pilot interviews up until 2006. So the guys who were referring that story to me were people who were kids prior to 2001. And in 2001, with September 11, the cockpit door became a secure door, and people were unable to enter the cockpit like I used to do as a kid, and just see the aeroplane and talk to the crew whilst in flight, which is truly inspirational. They can do it on the ground now, but I don't think it's quite the same. So it's interesting to consider what the repercussions of that cockpit door have caused for aviation careers that have never been seeded.
So what sustains your passion for the aviation industry?
The other day I was talking to a lady who had just joined. She's actually working for one of my clients, and she just started in the role at an aviation organization. And I said, you know, welcome aboard, referring to the aviation industry. And she made a comment about how, she actually made a comment to say that she has a book of acronyms on her desk that's this thick that she's currently reading through. But I said, look, prepare to be overwhelmed for a little while because it's incredibly detailed. But then what I wanted to do was, I wanted to impress upon her my passion for the industry that's actually driven by the detail. So I went on to explain to her that think about the, you know, the components of it. You know, I'm going to be flying up to Brisbane tomorrow morning. I am not even right now thinking about getting on that aeroplane, 7 a.m., Boeing 737. But if I looked hard enough, I'd be able to trace the life of pretty much every single component back to the birth of that component, even the metal on the aeroplane. I would be able to trace it back to the mine from which it came from, and it was smelted and turned into alloys that became the skin of the aeroplane. You know, the engine components will get to temperatures close to half the temperature of the surface of the sun. We'll be flying across the sky at, you know, 3/4 of the speed of sound, and I'll probably be waking my laptop or having a little bit of a snooze, completely blissfully unaware of the incredible amount of technology that surrounds me. And there's also the people aspect. And when you think about the pilots that had to be trained, that will be sitting in the front of the airplane, the cabin crew as well, the guys that are loading the aircraft, and the people that have made the schedules, and the people we never see running the operations control center and managing the revenue systems and the technology and the maintenance control and making sure the airplane is fixed, making sure the fuel of the aircraft is fueled and the fuel is of a certain quality, and we can trace all that all the way back to another sort of a mine that's the fuel comes from. And it all converges behind this curtain that the customer never appreciates. This incredible complexity and traceability to get my flight tomorrow morning in the sky. And I love sitting on top or sitting in front of all that complexity. And there is never ending detail in that complexity of how much there is to know, how much it is just to get that one airplane in the sky. And people just take that for granted. But when you actually then think about the fact that at any one moment in time, it's not just the entire planet coming together to put my flight in the sky for a one-off event tomorrow morning, but the whole globe right now has got roughly 3,500 to 4,000 airliners, not airplanes, airliners that are airborne, and I mean in the sky, at any one moment in time. And so that complexity that I just defined for my one flight is actually behind all those other flights. And those other flights actually depart at some location and they arrive at another location. And the converging complexity comes around that airplane yet again. We're actually doing this global magic. We're doing it to Six Sigma reliability, to the extent when there is a hull loss or a crash, it becomes notable news. And then as we saw in Haneda the other day, the survivability of when there is a failure is extraordinarily good as well. Ultimately, and the thing that I really love, and this is what I pressed upon the lady, that I'm actually part of this incredible magic that occurs every single day. And there's really three things that actually just drive it and make it happen. The first one is there is, of course, the economic principles that all the little parties within these supply chains, they actually want to make a buck. And the consumer is prepared to pay for time, because it's essentially what you're buying when you're flying an airplane. And so this incredible army or pyramid of supply chain actually is all just making a little buck along the way. So the commercial principle is the first thing that drives it. The second conductor, if you will, and I use conductor like an orchestra conductor, by the way. The second one would be simply the clock. And so that it all meshes together with amazing synchronicity, airplane schedules, crew rosters, maintenance timing. The supply chain is all governed by the logistics. And of course, the clock is subject to environmental issues such as weather and flight cancellations and all that sort of stuff. But you know what? It recovers. It recovers because the economic principles bring the recovery, and the clock is just the beating heart that sits in the background. But the third thing, and I actually think the third thing is actually the most interesting, the third thing that actually drives this global magic, welcome aboard, is the passion that's in the industry that I am not unique. I'm just another participant. There are hundreds and hundreds of pilots, flight attendants, engineers, airport people, executives, et cetera, in all sorts of airlines and suppliers to the aviation industry. And it's extraordinary, even the ones that I know that are actually cabin cleaners or airport security people or some of the more humble participants in our industry. They work at the airport because they love the energy of the airport. They have caught the bug, and in their own way, they choose to clean airplanes rather than arguably clean schools, or they choose to work at the security, customer passenger security area rather than work at some other security area because they choose to work with that energy. And that passion that people have all around the airline is, I think, the lubrication that makes it work. Because it's something that we all have in common, even if we're competitors and even if we're in different parts of that supply chain. And that's why I participate. And that's my source, to answer your question, of that endless energy.
That is interesting. I hadn't actually put those two things together, but it does make sense when you kind of think about it, the changes in, which actually flows really nicely into my next question. So I'm going to lead in with that.
I'm here to serve.
So you have over 30 years experience working in various areas of the industry, as you've mentioned. How has the industry changed, particularly in Australia? And maybe what are some of the biggest challenges that it faces today?
Yeah, the industry, naturally, technology is the first one that I'd highlight. When I first started, the only place you'd see technology really, and I'm even including the cockpit in this comment, but the only use of technology was for the reservation system, really, and which is actually, for your interest, one of the earliest uses commercially, as in a non-defense setting, of a in-network-based computer system is airline reservations. Because of the opportunity to simultaneously sell tickets in a large number of locations, but also yield manage the price of those tickets in order to maximize your profitability. I remember when I was at Hazelton Airlines in 1998, I was the second person in the company to get a computer after the chief pilot. Yeah, and then we all got email addresses. And then I helped Hazelton design the home page which is what we called the website at the time, because all it was a URL with a splash page that advertised the service. And if you wanted to book a ticket, you actually phoned the phone number that was on the web page. So today, we're now the use of computerization, even the guys that are loading aircraft have got an iPad to submit electronically via 4G, the load sheet that goes, the speed of light route of the cockpit, et cetera. It's a no-brainer, but technology is it has been probably the biggest single feature. One of the things that actually hasn't changed is I actually maintain that Australia is one of the most interesting aviation markets in the world. It's like we always have a little bit of everything down here. We're a little microcosm or a petri dish of everything that's interesting. With no disrespect to our dear friends in New Zealand, but I think we are a little bit bigger than New Zealand. So we've got things like the FIFO markets and, you know, we've got aerial agriculture like they do. And we've got, several different meaningful competitors competing across, primary capital cities, secondary regional centres and tertiary regional centres. And you've got your charter activity, et cetera, and international operations, of course. But you go to the US or Europe and you're dealing with a megalith and you lose sight and touch of what's going on. Whereas coming back to Australia, you've always got these moving parts of somebody having a crack, whether it's Compass back in the days when I was first around and then Compass Mark II. Impulse had a shot and was very successful in getting bought by Qantas and then rebirthed as Jetstar. And now, cutting to the chase via strategic aviation and a huge range of other attempts, JetGo, huge range of other attempts to have a crack in the seductive world of aviation as an airline. We've now got Bonza in the mix with the prime place, and actually I'd also put in a Rex on their domestic 737s as well. It's always interesting to watch what's going on, and that hasn't changed. There's always someone having a crack.
It is really interesting, based on previous conversations we've had around like ChatGPT. So you went from, being the second person to have a computer and an email address to now using ChatGPT.
Exactly. And I'm trying to work out personally, that's right, how to personally, we're both trying to work out how we can use ChatGPT to help our productivity. And, who would have thought about that? Well, who would have thought about that 12 months ago?
Oh, okay. So as you mentioned, lots of different things have happened in quite a short period of time, really, if you think about when the internet and all that kind of stuff first came out and all the technology that's come off the back of that. Where do you see the most innovation and the most exciting new developments happening in aviation? This can either be in Australia or kind of more globally.
I think we haven't probably seen it yet, but there is a day of reckoning when it comes to energy and aviation that is going to happen at some time in the future, and that will drive step change innovation. So we haven't solved it, but kerosene is the most wonderful source of energy. It's got but one downside, which is carbon emissions. Apart from that, you can store it, pump it. It'll fit in different shaped vessels, such as fuel tanks or underground tanks. It's got great storage life, so you can keep it for a while. And it's got high thermal, it's got high BTU, in other words, it's got a high energy content for either the weight or the volume, depending on what a measure you want. In fact, I heard a really great metaphor once where apocryphal, but the story was a first year chemistry class, the professor came in on the first day and said, ladies and gentlemen, if I was to fill this glass with any sort of substance in order to take 1,000 kilograms 1 kilometer vertically, what would you propose I fill it with? And, people came back with TNT and dynamite and all these other things. And he said, well, actually, I could just fill it with petroleum or kerosene because that's what that much energy can actually achieve. And that is hard to replace. So to answer your question, you've got this convergence of the environmental pressures and whatever your views are on man-made climate change. At the end of the day, even if we're just looking at reducing pollution as a noble pursuit, we should be able to do better than what we're currently doing with the burning of kerosene in order to drive aeroplanes. So what we're heading towards, whether it's some sort of electrical or hydrogen some other energy source alternative to what the current kerosene-powered world is based on, because we're getting diminishing returns on our... In fact, one of the problems is we're getting diminishing returns on our ability to get more efficiency out of the kerosene through composite aircraft and better engine technology, the diminishing returns for sure. Because at the same time as you actually have got those pursuits, the customer is simultaneously wanting more and more comfort, which is at odds to the customer's demands for comfort create kilograms of CO2 emissions in themselves. Seating capacity, comfortable chairs that weigh a certain amount, in-flight meals that have to be accommodated, etc. You've got this this cliff that you're heading towards where the technology will come, and it'll come in my lifetime, no doubt. So I'm really excited to see what that is and how it's efficiently delivered.
It's interesting that you've raised the impact of the things that happen inside the flight and their contributions to emissions as well. Because I think when people think about, say when you're like buying a ticket and it asks if you want to offset your emissions, I think most people kind of lend towards, the flight itself and the plane, but not necessarily how maybe their class selection or the meal selections that they make, or the fact that they've got maybe an in-flight entertainment that's embedded in the seat versus like an iPad, and how all of those different choices also impact those outputs.
Well, even just, and I'm just trying to illustrate a point here, but you have the cost of carriage of anything that goes in an aeroplane will cost you fuel to get it there, as it does. And so there is a cost of carriage that the difference between a lightly loaded aircraft and a fully laden aircraft that's flying, the same aeroplane flying between A and B, will have a different fuel burn, and that can be converted into what's known as the cost of carriage of the difference between the two weights. So consequently, to take your point, even if one was to take a large amount of bags, or actually, here's a better example, one was to choose air freight over sea freight, maybe, because one is greedy about getting one's eBay purchases quickly, that actually has that will go in the air, and that to fly it in the air actually will burn will cost you kerosene, which will actually turn into carbon.
So changing track slightly. So you're also on the board of advice for the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies, or ITLS for short.
Mm-hmm.
So in what capacity do you support ITLS as being on the board?
It was my privilege actually to be asked to be on the board back in 2015. And when I think about it now, I'm possibly one of the longest standing members, actually. At the time I was in a role within Qantas. I was looking after the suite of regional airports that the Qantas Group has around the country, which includes, there was 57 airports. And so the desire to get involved in something like the ITLS was, it really fitted with my interest. There was just strong alignment, is I guess what I'm trying to say. What I really brought to it, though, was I brought what I really... saw as my mission were two things. The first one was that when I talked about when I was a pilot and then I chose to then convert to pursuing a career on the ground, it actually took me a year to get that first job on the ground. That, because we're dealing with recruitment in the pre-internet era. And and so consequently, some of the older listeners may be aware of Friday's Australian newspaper, Friday's Australian had an aviation supplement. So every Friday we would all get Friday's Oz, and we'd look at the job ads. And so it just took me a year to just crack an entry-level job in an airline. And the airline was, I was blessed to, which is Hazelton. And to this day, I still have a soft spot for ZL, which has now become Rex. So I've still got a soft spot for those guys. Cheer them on all the time. And I love their 737 product when I fly on it. My frustration and I was the most enthusiastic applicant. I would have hired me, and I still would have. If I met the junior me, I still would have been a heartbeat. But I couldn't get a look in. And so the first reason of two that I see it as my mission on the board of advice is to be a conduit for the really good grants that come out of the academic programs and help them find their first jobs. And I had a bit of a mechanism that I used to run when I was in Qantas and in the Qantas group, which is in a variety of different business units, which included Jetstar, Qantas Mainline Freight and Catering. And I continually had a little production line of ITLS graduates who had come in to work with me on an internship, which means they'd work for me for several days a week, just free of charge. And my mission was to convert their enthusiasm and their gift to me with the free brains. We got great kids out of the ITLS. And my mission was to, roughly 3 months that I had with them, to introduce them to as many people as I could, to facilitate as many, opportunities to access corners of the business that operations control, all the bits that you don't get to see. And in doing so, create an internal awareness of all the different roles that exist in the airline, and then allowed them to then pursue a subset of the roles that were simultaneously of interest to them, but also importantly advertised to them. And they had the advantage of being, because they were with me for 3 months, they had a red ASIC around their neck, because that was one of the requirements, and they were almost like an internal applicant. And I'm really proud to say that of all the interns that I had over that time, only one was unsuccessful in finding a job in that 3 months. So in a sense, I tried to solve what I found to be the problem that I had to struggle with, and to make it easy for, great, enthusiastic young kids to find their jobs in aviation. The second reason that I'm involved is that my dad was actually an academic at Sydney Uni, and he was in the geography department, and he actually worked out of the Institute building, which is ironically just adjacent to where the ITLS is. So it's actually quite nostalgic for me to be part of the University of Sydney. That means something to me because of the connection to my dad. I actually have got a soft spot for Sydney Uni, and as a subset of that, passion for aviation. So that converges nicely with participating on the board of advice for the ITLS.
When I interviewed Carly McGowan, she said the exact same thing about grads and wanting to provide opportunities for the next generation of people coming through, in her case, supply chain. And taking the ITLS grads. You might have covered this already, but I'll ask you the question just in case. What do you think makes the ITLS kind of unique or special compared to maybe other departments in other unis or other boards of advisors that try and do something similar?
It's actually, if I'd say it's extremely academic. I mean that as a compliment, not a criticism. And I guess what I'm trying to say is it's very, very, it brings an incredibly high level of intelligence to the game. So it's trading on brains. That's the ITLS, not myself. What I like is that it brings those brains, but it brings them to the lens of the of transport and logistics. Not just to bring a more operational, practical approach to a specific segment of transport and logistics, such as an aviation degree. And I do want to really clarify here, Em, that I'm not disparaging aviation degrees. In fact, my undergraduate degree was an aviation degree in aviation management, which I relish and I still leverage learnings from that, frankly, every day. But the ITLS is operating at a different level. And as a result of being able to operate at a different level, it's actually able to be not just an educator, but a solutions provider. And it's able to take the smart kids, turn those into opportunities for further research that could be made available either commercially or through other channels, pro bono, to organizations and community as a result of what it brings together. All of us sit on the board of advice pro bono, right? But I actually feel privileged to be there to be part of the conversations, and I feel very excited some of the things that the team are talking about with respect to future use of technology with transport planning, etc. I learn stuff every day. In fact, even the conversation that you and I had at the last one with ChatGPT was again, a step change in learnings for me. So I go to it to selfishly receive, even though I also do try to give as per the getting students jobs example that I provided before. The other thing I'd say is It's also a collection of some of the most interesting people you'll ever meet, right?
Yeah.
They're in a way, they're kindred spirits. They've got this deep interest in something that you're either exactly overlapping with or got proximity interest that you can go, I'm interested in what you're doing there or what you're saying. So, yeah, it's very, very stimulating, just the individuals.
So how can people reach out maybe to learn more about you or to learn about Leading Edge Consulting, the company that you run? I'll also include any links and things as well. But where's the best place?
I would love it if people reach out. As a card-carrying extrovert, I love making friends and connecting with people. Whether you need something from me, can help in some way, give me a call. The best way to do it is if you go to my website, you'll easily find my phone number. Or alternatively, LinkedIn may be the vehicle of choice. And if you just go to either my name, which is probably easier, just Todd Chapman, you'll see that I work for Leading Edge Management Consulting, and you'll be able to send me a, you'll be able to confirm it's me, and you'll just be able to send me one of those LinkedIn emails, which I'll read and get back to whoever it is. As a card-carrying extrovert for 30 years in the aviation industry, I've got an excellent network across airlines and airports and all the organizations that support those. That's my career has been based on building those relationships. So potentially I can also stitch you into a new friend if you need an introduction.
Perfect. Well, Todd, thanks so much for your time and for all your insights and for kind of sharing your passions and all your stories.
It's been my pleasure. Em, thank you so much for asking me. I was really humbled when you did, and it's been my pleasure to talk for 30-odd minutes. So thank you.
To learn more about any of the guests that we have on the Bite Size podcast, you can check out our show notes at compassiot.substack.com. Alternatively, if you'd like to know more about the company that runs this podcast, Compass IoT, you can visit our website, which is compassiot.com.au.